I understand the connection will be up during some of the breaks. If you wish to have some discussion with me, we can probably arrange that. But in practice, you may find it easier and more convenient to talk in person with my student and collaborator, Ian Morrison, who is there in Waterloo. Ian, can you wave? Make sure folks know who you are. Great, thanks. Ian will be very happy to talk to any of you at length. He is looking for a job, so he has motivation. And if you go to the next slide, I'll use that as an excuse to make a brief plug for an unrelated paper. That is to say, today I wish to talk about three gravitons in the cyberspace, but I'll make a 30-second mention of a paper that appeared recently on the archive, which has to do with interacting massive scalar fields in the center space, in which we work out correlators in the Hartle-Hawking state of an arbitrary massive interacting scalar field on the center space to all orders of perturbation theory, and show that the correlators decay at large separation, that is indeed by R, as one would naively expect. I don't want to get distracted with various issues about this, but I wanted to mention it. I also wanted to mention that Ian will be happy to talk to you about this work, and any of you who have concerns about the intrinsic analytic continuation from Euclidean involved in considering the Hartle-Hawking state will enjoy Atsushi Higuchi's talk tomorrow. So, if we can go to the next slide, I'll tell you what I'll begin my talk for today. So today I wish to discuss, if you will, the issue that's been raised by several people already, which has to do with large infrared effects in graviton propagators, or in free gravitons in the center space. And I'm going to stop at the free level. My talk today has nothing to do with interactions. I want to make life as simple as possible. This, of course, is an old issue. I have mentioned some names of people who have repeatedly emphasized this over the years, including Sarbinsky, Woodard, Antonius Capella, and also more recently, Steve Giddings, etc. If you would like to have your name added or subtracted from this list, drop me an email, and I'll make appropriate changes in future versions. Of course, some of the issues that we're talking about have been discussed several times already today. For a classic example is that, for example, if you work in transverse traceless synchronous gauge in the flat slicing of the sitter space, if you try to write down the propagator in the obvious vacuum, it suffers a d3k over k cubed divergence in 3 plus 1 dimensions and doesn't exist. Similarly, as has been discussed, I think, probably in Steve Giddings' talk, if not elsewhere, if you find a state that does exist, it is typically the case that if you compute that what's called the variance of the graviton, which has to do with computing the propagator at some finite separation, which is held fixed in physical units, if you then take that variance and push it off to future infinity, it's typically the case that it grows in various gauges. That's another example of large IR effect. So if we can go to the next slide, please. I am interested in the question, as many people here are, of what is the physics of this phenomenon? And in particular, this is similar to the question that Urakawa and his collaborator Tanaka were asking in their talk this morning, except that I'm going to focus today on the simple context of free gravitons in de-center space, as opposed to worrying about complications of scalar fields and equations and so forth. So I'm interested in the question of, might these large IR effects, at least in this limited context, be a gauge artifact, either entirely or in part? Some of these issues have been discussed a lot. I'm not sure I need to read everything which is on the slide. Let me, in fact, just go on to the next slide and say there are various arguments pro and con, some of which I'll discuss more as the talk progresses. Okay. So, I would like to probe this question, the issue of these large IR effects, by looking at one specific property which has some relation to large IR effects but is logically separate. I'd like to probe the question of the de-Sitter invariance of the graviton vacuum. Okay? And as a reminder, if you compute correlators of local gauge invariance like the Weyl tensor, well, they're de-Sitter invariant in the standard vacuum. But if you write down, but most propagators that have been written down for the graviton themselves appear to break the de-Sitter invariance. So the question is this breaking of the de-Sitter invariance in the propagator merely a gauge artifact or not? What I like about this question of de Sitter invariance is it's a sharp gauge invariant question, and in principle should remain so at all orders in perturbation theory. I'll emphasize that more and explain it in a bit. So how is this related to the issue of large IR effects? Well, let's just think about the case. Suppose that the graviton vacuum really is de Sitter invariant. Well, that means that in particular, well, it means it shares all the symmetries of the de Sitter space. So I've drawn for you, of course, the standard conformal.
You made a monument for the world for 10 minutes.
That's right.
He's holding it.
It's funny things you do on
the screen. Now he's still talking, I guess.
He's not dialing in.
That the discussion for some quantum field is not invariant, then the notion of the variance defined by the Hubble scale apart.
Hey, Don.
Five independent and can't grow apart.
I think we lost the connection. We lost you for about a minute. Do you think you could?
Did you?
Yeah. But we're glad you're back. So maybe a minute.
All right. You've all read my slide by now. Do I need? All I've been doing is basically saying what's on the slide. Do I need to repeat this, or is this clear? The point is, as I summarize the bottom, that I want to ask about de Sitter invariance. De Sitter invariant, if the state is de Sitter invariant, if the graviton has a de Sitter invariant state, this would constrain, although not preclude, large IR effects. It doesn't preclude large IR effects because it allows large IR effects that are large in the sense that they grow as the de Sitter invariant separation of the points increases. But of course, it would rule out a directly physical interpretation of, for example, a growing variance if the variance is something I can compute by taking points that are within a Hubble scale apart, because then I can put those points inside the static patch of de Sitter, which is the right wedge here, and then I can use de Sitter invariance to argue that that quantity, if it's physical, must be invariant in the de Sitter time translation. Okay, so I want to ask about de Sitter invariance. It's some way of probing this question of whether these large IR effects are invariant, perhaps learning something. All right, next slide, please. Okay, so there is, of course, even on this specific point, a certain amount of tension in the literature. There are arguments, I've listed some authors that have certainly argued for breaking of de Sitter invariance in the graviton vacuum. And I've also listed some authors who have argued for preservation of de Sitter invariance in the graviton vacuum. I do not want to review all of these arguments today, because that would take too much time, and I think most of them are not relevant to what I have to say. In particular, I should mention that there are a set of invariance preservation arguments by Higuchi having to do with constructing explicitly de Sitter invariant propagators, and that Richard Woodard has raised various issues with those propagators, and those propagators have nothing to do with what I'm going to say from now on today. So we can set all those issues aside and not discuss them.
Don, I don't want to object to the propagators. I just want to object to your de Sitter invariance of the vacuum argument about it precluding growing terms. Suppose I would say de Sitter invariance of the vacuum would tell us that the propagator was a de Sitter invariant function of the two points that we look at it at, but that just tells us that suppose we consider a higher order effect which requires an integration over vertices. We could take totally invariant things, like, for example, the volume of the past light cone. Suppose the propagator contains a term like theta of the light cone. So it's one inside the past light cone and zero outside. That's completely invariant and could be a term, and in fact is a term in the retarded Green's function. But if we had to integrate that in an interaction vertex, we would get something that broke the sitter invariance because, of course, it grows with time.
Indeed. So for today, I'd like to just to do something simple, and as you'll see, this is work in progress, it's not even completed. I want to carefully understand the free graviton vacuum and save all issues and interactions for later. Okay. Very good. Even here, for the free graviton vacuum, there is a tension in the literature, which I want to highlight. I want to highlight a certain aspect of it. For my purposes, I would like to focus on the pro-symmetry breaking paper by Kleppe and a certain pro-de-sitter invariance paper by Higuchi. So if we go to the next slide, I will explain that. Okay. Now, before Richard objects, I do want to refer to this pro-symmetry breaking paper by Kleppe from 1993, breaking the sitter invariance in quantum cosmological gravity. What I wrote on the slide is not quite correct, so I'll correct it. What I wrote on the slide is that he shows that there is no de Sitter invariant propagator in transverse traceless synchronous gauge in the k equals zero slicing. That's not quite correct. What he proved is much stronger than the words actually written there. What's correct is that he worked in a particular gauge, which happens to have been transverse traceless synchronous gauge in the flat cosmological slicing. And what he did is really to show that there is no well-defined propagator for which the action of the de Sitter transformations can be fully compensated by gauge transformations. In other words, he showed that any well-defined propagator in this gauge contains gauge-invariant information which is not de Sitter invariant. And that seems to be the third conclusion of his paper. So I wanted to mention that. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this work. I'm not going to review it in detail, but that's a conclusion that's out there. Go to the next slide, please. On the other hand, I want to remind you of an old paper by Atsushi Higuchi. This is a paper which is not well known in the cosmology community, but is more well known in the quantum gravity community. And it's an interesting paper. Atsushi has other purposes in mind in this paper, but as an intermediate step, what he does is to study the graviton in, again, a transverse traceless synchronous gauge, but in terms of the global coordinates, the spherical slices of the sitter space. What he does there is to construct this state, a natural vacuum state, and then does something very nice. He computes the generators of the de Sitter transformation. These are the charges, if you will, that generate the de Sitter isometries, the SOD, 1 transformations, and he shows that they annihilate the vacuum state. They get zero on the right-hand side. And what's nice about this calculation is that, as is very clear in linearized gravity, these de Sitter charges, the QI of my slides, are manifestly gauge invariant quantities. So this is a gauge invariant state. Okay. So, and I should mention that, morally speaking, this calculation is equivalent to showing that the propagator in this gauge, if you act on it with an SOD, 1 transformation, can be compensated by some kind of gauge transformation. So there appears to be a real tension between these two papers. So let's stop for a minute and review some logical possibilities of what might be going on. Okay? Possibility number one is that there is an error in one of these two papers. Okay? I've read both papers and I've checked various calculations. In particular, I've checked the Higuchi paper in some detail and I have found no errors. So I'd like to discard this possibility for today's discussion. Assume that the calculations presented are both correct. Possibility number two. Is it possible that somehow they're referring to different Hilbert spaces of states? After all, the Kleppe paper is not talking about any particular state. It's talking about a huge class of states. Well, I think the answer is no. We can't resolve this by just saying there are different Hilbert spaces involved, in particular because if I understand the Kleppe paper correctly, it doesn't actually worry about whether any two propagators he considers lie in the same Hilbert space. He should effectively be considering all possible Hilbert spaces that are compatible with the free gravitons. Not only that, from the global point of view, if we think about de Sitter space in terms of the global coordinates, where the Cauchy slices are compact spheres, we know that there should not be more than one possible Hilbert space, because it's a theorem in quantum field theory in curved spacetime that for free fields with compact Cauchy slices, on spacetimes with compact Cauchy slices, there is a unique Hilbert space for which all states are Hadamard. So there should be just one state to discuss. Okay. Possibility number three is that there's something intrinsically singular about at least one of these gauges, and the two analyses are not equivalent because of the gauge issue. Now, that seems like the likely answer to me. And again, the Higuchi paper really does a gauge invariant calculation in that he constructs gauge invariant generators and shows that they annihilate the graviton vacuum. So it seems to me the natural conjecture is that there's something singular about transverse traceless synchronous gauge in the flat slicing. Oh, I should also say that Higuchi in his paper gives an explicit argument verifying that transverse traceless synchronous gauge in the global slicing is a good gauge condition, and so adopting the strategy, the philosophy for today that we assume there are no errors in the published calculations, again, the only conclusion left appears to be there's something singular about transverse traceless synchronous gauge in the flat slicing on global de Sitter space. Okay, so that's what I'd like to explore in the rest of this talk. And how much time do I have for the rest of this talk?
30 minutes,
great. As you see, I have very little to say, so this is not going to be a problem. Okay, next slide, please. So, in fact, I have to say, I'm somewhat embarrassed to giving this talk today for several reasons. One is that this is an analysis that surely must have been done by someone 20, 30 years ago, I would think. I have, however, been unable to find it in the literature, and asking a few people who are at least more expert than I've been unable to find any references to it. So if you know where this has been done, please let me know, okay? Especially so since, as I mentioned in the first slide, this is work in progress, and that's the second reason I'm embarrassed to give this talk today, is that the truth is we have not yet pushed this calculation through to its final conclusions, mostly because we were hurrying to get that other paper out that just appeared on the archive. So there'll be some residual ambiguity at the end of the talk today. The reason I'm giving this talk to you without a definite conclusion is because, first of all, I'm hoping one of you will save us during the rest of the calculation by telling us that it's there in the literature. But also, I think this is a useful point of discussion for the conference here to understand if indeed this favorite gauge of many people has some kind of singularity. So let's try to understand what's going on. Oh, I should say that while I have not seen this particular calculation or analysis in the literature, there is certainly a great deal of overlap or connection between what I have to say here and the talk that Urakawa gave this morning, although again, I'm going to talk about just free gravitons in the Sitter space, no interactions, no inflation, no scalar fields. Okay, so I wish to ask this question that, as I said, I would have thought, I still think someone must have done this long ago, but I don't know where to find it. I want to ask the question, if someone gives me an arbitrary perturbation, which is a well-defined perturbation, a nice, smooth tensor field on global de Sitter space, but otherwise arbitrary, is it true that we can find a gauge-related perturbation, something given by adding a linearized diffeomorphism, which satisfies transverse, traceless, synchronous gauge defined by the flat slicing coordinates? Okay. So, just so we're all clear, right, I've written down the gauge conditions. Transversality means that we want to break this free perturbation. Tracelessness means its trace is zero. Synchronous means that H00 and H0i vanish. And I'm interested in coordinates where de Sitter space looks like the metric given. That's the de Sitter length scale L squared divided by the time that I've called lambda squared times minus d lambda squared plus dx squared. And of course, just so we all remember, the conformal diagram of de Sitter is over at the right. The red lines are constant lambda slices, constant time slices in this particular coordinate system. And the blue lines, just for reference, are the spherical slices in constant global time. Okay. Now, In principle, we should analyze all of these gauge conditions, but as I said, I'm going to adopt the point of view that the calculations I referred to in the literature are correct. So from that point of view, Atsushi has shown us that transverse traceless synchronous gauge is fine in global coordinates. The transverse condition and the traceless condition are the same in all coordinates. They're covariant, so there can't be any problem with them. Great. So I will assume for the talk today that there are no problems with either transversality or the traceless condition. I will assume that we are, in fact, given, therefore, this H bar, which is already going to be transverse and traceless, and I'll just ask what happens if we try to impose the synchronous gauge conditions. I should also admit that the other reason I'm doing it this way is that this is the calculation we've actually done. So I'll show you what we've actually done so far. All right. So, next slide, please. Great. This slide was actually a copying error. We want to go one more slide. Okay. So this should be the slide where after the metric, it says, for this talk, we're going to assume no problems with transverse traceless. But it points out that there are residual gauge transformations that are allowed. So just to remind everyone, I'm going to assume that we've already imposed transverse gauge and traceless gauge. In principle, my first year GR students would tell me that there's some problem with that, that I've imposed already D plus one conditions, whereas I only have D gauge freedoms. But of course, the way this works is that after you impose the transverse condition, the traceless condition is easier because in transverse gauge, the trace of the metric satisfies a hyperbolic wave equation. So all you have to do is set the trace to zero at an initial time and also set its first time derivative to zero at an initial time, and it remains zero throughout. You can principle that with residual gauge transformations. In the same way, if we've already imposed transverse and traceless gauge, it turns out that you can impose the synchronous gauge conditions. This is, of course, standard kind of textbook material. You can impose the synchronous gauge conditions by fixing H00 and H0i to vanish at some initial time, and also fixing their first time derivatives to vanish at the same initial time, and then the equations of motion sort everything else out for you. Okay. So what we want to do is to solve, is to find some gauge transformation, some infinitesimal diffeomorphism given by a vector field C that sets H00 and H0i to zero at some time, as well as their first time derivatives. Then the diffeomorphism is determined at all times by the fact that it satisfies a wave equation, and also by the fact that that it is in fact also transverse due to the traceless condition. I've written the wave equation satisfies over on the right to you on the right hand side of the slide just for reference. Okay. So let's go to the next slide. I just want to emphasize the structure of the equations is that because we're going to solve for the vector field CA and also for its first time derivatives, so CA dot isn't what we're solving for, and in addition, because CA satisfies a wave equation, we have a relation between its second time derivatives and spatial derivatives. That means if, in writing down the equations, any second time derivative appears, we can replace it with lower time derivatives. So the equations we're going to solve will not be hyperbolic. They won't involve second time derivatives. And because we're solving for CA dot, there's a sense in which they don't involve first time derivatives either. That is to say, the first time derivatives are things we're solving for. So you're not going to get parabolic equations. You expect to get just equations on one slice. Of course, you do. You get elliptic partial differential equations, which are notable because they mean that the solution depends on the initial data over the entire slice, depends on the boundary conditions, even up in the far corner of the sigma space. Great. If you start plugging through the various algebra, it's not hard to check that you can solve for the time component of the vector field, the time derivative of the time component of the vector field, and the time derivative of the space components of the vector field algebraically in terms of derivatives of the vector field itself on your given slice, and some sources that come from H00, H0i, and their time derivatives in the given perturbation. Since those are algebraic equations, and of course they're linear, if I'm doing linearized gravitons, They're solvable. There's no obstructions. There's no problems. Okay. So what's left is got to be some kind of differential equation that now only involves Ci. We've eliminated, we've already solved for the time components. So the Ci's are the space components of this vector field. We've already solved for the time components. We've solved for all the time derivatives in terms of these space components. The only things left to solve for are these space components. So there's some differential equation, and it has to respect the symmetries of the problem. The symmetries of the problem are the symmetries of the gauge conditions, which of course are the symmetries of this k equals 0 slicing. They are Euclidean symmetry and a scaling symmetry. So that restricts the form of the differential equation. And if we go to the next slide, I'll show you the possible terms. It's not hard to see that the equation has to be of the form some kind of source for the perturbation you're given is equal to, there's three possible terms, one of it which looks like the standard flat space scalar Laplacian acting on this vector field. I've normalized this equation by setting its coefficient to 1. That's just normalization for writing on the equation. Then there can be another term where the index structure is different for the derivative. It can come with some coefficient, which must, by the symmetries, be a constant, called that A. Then there can be some mass-like term, although because of the scale symmetry, the dilatation symmetry, it can't be a constant mass term. It has to be a kind of time-dependent mass term, where, remember, lambda is this cosmological time. That's the coefficient B. And similarly, the source, it turns out, can be a combination of three terms. It can depend on h0i dot, spatial derivatives of h0,0, and h0i itself with a factor of 1. Great. So the only question is, what are these coefficients? And this is the calculation that we've actually done. So I'll show you the answer on the next slide. And of course, it's a calculation one has to do. You'll have to just trust us. These are the results. Thank you. Next slide. Yes, so we should now be on the slide that has the equation at the top. It says calculations give various coefficients. So I've done these calculations, and Ian has independently checked them.
Are there a question here?
Yeah.
Ah, isn't she? Yeah.
Can you explain again why the last term was 1 over lambda squared?
The dilatation symmetry. So you'll notice that, let's look at the top equation here, right? The first two terms involve derivatives, so if you scale them, they scale with 2 powers of the scale. We need the same scaling in the last term, well, 2 powers of the scale in addition to the one that comes with the vector index. So the same must be true of the last term. So it's 1 over, the 1 over lambda squared is just to match the fact that there is a 1 over length squared from the derivative squared in the first two terms. Was that clear? I have a feeling I muddled that. But
so there's no other possible mass scale in the problem.
That's right. There is no mass scale in the problem, and there can't be by symmetries. That's why this is not really a mass term. It's a mass-like term if you evaluate it at fixed lambda. Okay? But this term is compatible with the symmetries of the problem. If you like, you can think about it as a time-dependent mass, which would be compatible with the symmetries. Because in this problem, there's, remember, the cosmological coordinates, there's no time translation symmetry. There's no lambda translation symmetry. There's only a dilatation symmetry that scales lambda and the spatial coordinates simultaneously. Okay? So that's not, in fact, fixed to zero by the symmetries. If you look at the result of the calculations, though, it does turn out coefficient B is zero. So there's various coefficients. Let me tell you what the important answers are. So this coefficient A is d minus 3 over d minus 1. All that's important is that it's bigger than minus 1. Okay? If it's bigger than minus 1, you can check that the eigenvalues of the differential part of the operator, the kinetic term, all have the same sign, so the operator is really elliptic. Okay? That's all that really matters. And in particular, it means that you can bound the operator between two massive Laplacians. So even though this index structure is a little complicated, you know basically what it looks like. What's also important and interesting is that the coefficient B happens to be zero when it's calculated. So the operator L, although this is not guaranteed by symmetry, is in fact a massless operator. So it's something that this L is the operator that acts on C. So the linear operator is something which is basically a Laplacian. You can bound it between the Laplacian and a plus 1 times the Laplacian. So you know how it behaves, and you know how to solve equations with it. You know that it has some Green's function, which in position space goes more or less like r to the minus d minus 3. And in particular, it goes like 1 over r in 4 dimensions. Okay. There are also various coefficients in the source, but their exact form is not important. What's important to note is that if you wanted to solve this equation using a Green's function, you would note that the Green's function integral converges only if the source dies off sufficiently fast at infinity. And in particular, it needs to fall off like r to the minus 2 or higher in any dimension in order for the Green's function integral to exist. Now, a couple of comments. First of all, had the B coefficient represented a positive mass squared term, then of course you would have exponential fall off of the Green's function, and so it would be much easier for solutions to exist in this way. That's comment number one. Comment number two is that if my condition on the source is not satisfied, if the source falls off more slowly, that means the Green's function integral fails to converge. It doesn't necessarily mean that there is no solution. It just means the solution grows perhaps rapidly at large r. So one needs to think carefully about what this means for various kinds of boundary conditions. All right. Next slide, please. So, again, at some point, it's the calculation that you have to kind of trust us. The answer is that, I'll show you some of the how you do this calculation, or how we did this calculation. What we did was said, okay, we want to take some legitimate solution on global de Sitter, which is already transverse and traceless, and use it to compute this source and see how fast it falls off with R. So what legitimate solution did we choose? Well, we said, let's just choose one of the transverse, traceless, synchronous modes from global coordinates. That's a nice, easy thing to look at. What's nice about that is that a lot of the components of the perturbation already vanish in global coordinates, and as a result, the transformation to these k equals zero coordinates is fairly straightforward. In fact, because both sets of coordinates have a spherical symmetry, and you can use the same angles on a sphere which is two dimensions smaller than de Sitter space itself, it turns out this transformation only really involves mapping two coordinates in the global case to two coordinates in the k equals zero case, and it's a simple kind of calculation you can go through. At some level, you're just going to trust us you can either check for yourself later or trust us now and do the calculation directly. So let's go to the next slide and I'll show you the result. And the claim that we are making is that you can use this source, which would give a finite Green's function solution for the gauge transformation only if it falls off by r cubed or greater. In fact, this source only decays like 1 over r. So the Green's function does not converge, and you have to do something more clever to solve the equation. I didn't write it on the slide, but you can try to do something more clever, and you can estimate that what actually happens is that the spatial components of this gauge transformation grow, in fact, grow linearly with R as a result of this source, and they become large at large R. And if you convert that into global coordinates, you find that as you approach r equals infinity along these k equals zero slices, that in fact the components in the global coordinate system actually grow like basically 1 over, so there's an angle, a polar angle theta, which goes to pi at the south pole, which is the left vertical line, which is, so it's pi at this corner that all of the k equals zero slices approach. So it turns out you can show that in global coordinates, this diffeomorphism goes like 1 over pi minus theta cubed. It diverges rather strongly. Okay, so that's the calculation we've actually done. Obviously, where I'm going is that this seems to suggest, this is the step that we have not rigorously completed, this seems to suggest that there should be no smooth solution to that equation I wrote down that governs the residual transformations, which gives this behavior and grows this rapidly at large R. Which I'd like to suggest that perhaps when we complete this calculation, we'll find that it is simply not possible to take a generic perturbation on global De Sitter space and to rewrite it in this transverse traceless synchronous gauge defined by the flat slicing using a smooth gauge transformation. That's what I would like to suggest may be the outcome of this calculation. All right. So let's go on to the next slide, which is just my final summary, and then we'll have a discussion, and people can tell me if this calculation has been completed in the literature and what the story is. So what I've claimed is that if you try to just impose the gauge condition, which is a common one for doing various analyses, and try to impose transverse, traceless, synchronous gauge in flat topological slicing, you get various equations, and you find out that the source generically falls off too slowly in order for the equations to be solved using a Green's function. What this tells you is that, in fact, if there is a diffeomorphism that enacts this transformation, it must grow rapidly at large R, and it raises the question of whether there's a smooth solution to the diffeomorphism, for example, across the cosmological horizon. All right. So, I mean, certainly, well, right. So I'd like to also comment that if you're not working on global De Sitter space, if you instead work in these flat slicing FRW coordinates and wish to work on a torus where you periodically identify the space coordinates, then it turns out that there is no such issue. You might have actually thought from my analysis that there might be an issue, because looking at my equation, it's a massless differential operator, so it looks like there could be a zero mode problem. If the source has a non-zero value for its zero mode, even on a torus, there'll be no solution for the vector field C. However, it turns out you can show that for any metric which is periodic on a torus, the zero mode of this source necessarily vanishes, because I assumed in computing the equation that the transversality condition is satisfied. So I just want to comment that the issue I'm raising is perhaps an issue for global De Sitter space, but does not have any analog if you consider a quotient to De Sitter space, or if you work on flat slicing FRW currently identified on torus. The idea is that if indeed this conclusion is correct, if indeed the conclusion is correct that there is no real way to make this gauge transformation on global De Sitter space, that this could resolve a tension in the literature and support the argument that really the graviton vacuum is De Sitter invariant. It's just that when you try to write down this well-defined, useful De Sitter invariant vacuum state, you try to write it down in a gauge where the metric is forced to be transverse, traceless, and synchronous in the cosmological coordinates, that causes the expression to diverge due to a divergent gauge transformation. That's what I'd like to suggest as a possible resolution. If that's the case, it would tell us that there cannot be gauge invariant large infrared effects at distances smaller than the horizon scale, and in particular, any kind of gauge invariant correlator that could be computed inside the static patch must be time independent and therefore bounded at large times in the context I'm discussing, which is just the moment free gravitons in De Sitter space. And of course, we could then ask about higher order perturbations, and it's probably useful to separate the case where the graviton interacts with massless scalars or scalars with flat potential from the case where the graviton interacts only with massive scalars or with other fields that are known on their own to preserve the same fields. Okay, that's my story. I realize it's very late there in Waterloo, so thank you for staying with me and listening to the end. I think it's time for some questions.
Can you see people though, or do you want me to call
them? So let me start by following on a few of them. Richard, I'm going to save you for a few minutes, but I think your schedule will be lengthy, but I'll get to you. So there's someone whose face I can't make out in the right on the back. Yes, you? Yes, please?
I'm your colleague.
You can ask him the question.
What's that?
He says your face is
Richard,
familiar.
I can't resolve noses from eyes.
Anyway, so quick question or slash comment. So
yes.
Coming back to the torus or any fixed co-moving cutoff, you say it does work. You can choose a gauge without this kind of problem, right?
Yes, I see no problem. Let me think separately later offline about your question of any co-moving cutoff.
Okay, let's take the torus. I'm happy with that.
But I think it's probably true. But for the torus, yes, there's no problem with this kind of gauge.
Okay.
That I can see.
And in that case, you do have a growing variance with time. You can think of, you know, setting the scale of the torus
yes.
to be larger than the co-moving length cut off from the beginning of inflation or what have you.
Sure.
And you have a, you know, a growth of the variance with time, and ultimately in the infinite time limit of divergence.
So let's talk about what. Assuming that the rest of this story plays out as advertised, let's talk about the implications for your toroidal case. Okay. So, of course, if you took a toroidal inflating spacetime, no matter what torus size you choose, if it inflates long enough, eventually it becomes much bigger than the horizon scale. Okay. And as a result, at late times, you might well expect that the physics in that system is the same as it would be in infinite de Sitter space. You might well expect so. Okay? So, you know, there's various I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed, but I think that this... So in your torus case, of course, I can't ask my clean, sharp question about de Sitter invariance, because de Sitter invariance is obviously broken. Okay? But what I think this would suggest, again, maybe to be thought through more carefully, is that even in the torus case, if this plays out, it would suggest that even the torus case, thinking of this variance as picking out a local vector field, is probably too naive an interpretation. Okay? What this would suggest is that at least that aspect of it would, in fact, be some kind of gauge artifact, and that, yes, it's true, you could choose this gauge, and in this gauge you find a growing variance, but If you could calculate something that was gauge invariant and also local, that stayed within a Hubble scale, you should not see anything like a growing variance. Okay, great. Next question, on the left of Richard there, or right of Richard.
Okay. I guess it's me, huh? Well,
I have no problem with faces. Richard, I can see clearly.
Richard probably has much bigger head than I have.
Older, so it shines.
But anyway, so I'm quite confused with your talk for the following reason. Please, I'll make this very simple statement, and please let me know where it's incorrect. So if I just write the quadratic action in Primer over to Walker, let's say, it can be the sitter, of course, and in, let's say, flat section, that's what I've done. And I think some people have also done it for curved sections.
Okay.
And what I can do is I can actually define this action in terms of gauge invariant variables, to linear order, of course. And in this way, I will separate tensor, scale, etc. Terms, and it's well known that in Primer over to Walker spaces, scale vector tensor separate. And then I'll get the graviton action as the action for the transverse traceless part, which doesn't couple to anything else, and that's a gauge invariant statement. And then I can solve for the graviton, and I'll find the infrared problem.
Yes.
So my question is, where is my reasoning going wrong, and how does it clash with what you've just said?
Your gauge invariant variables are not local, right? They're defined by your transverse traceless decomposition. They're defined, again, by solving elliptic differential equations over the entire slice.
That is true, yeah.
So they are not an example of the correlators that I wanted to talk about, which are things you can compute entirely within a Hubble scale. Those are the things
okay.
that, as I say, cannot have a growing variance.
Okay.
I hope that answers the question.
Maybe in the back?
Okay.
You mentioned about the propagator in K plus one slicing. Do you have
yes.
the form of it?
Atsushi does. You should ask Atsushi, you should ask Atsushi for details.
There is an analytic form for it?
Yes.
Yes. Very impressive calculation.
Very complicated.
Not the paper that I referenced, but Atsushi can give you the reference.
Okay.
Good. So, Richard, thank you for your patience.
There's one more.
You probably can't see me.
All right.
As somebody who was involved in this field even before I got in it.
Don, I just want to make a few comments. First of all, I know it's common in the literature, but it's strictly speaking not correct to impose more than four gauge conditions because you have only four functions, which are specifying diffeomorphisms. What you should do, and maybe this doesn't affect what you have to say, but it would affect the presentation, I think, is to choose, make your choice, whatever you want, the synchronous gauge conditions say, and then solve the constraints that result in that gauge, and solving those constraints, then you may be able to put the other components to zero as you wish, but you have to do that. And solving those constraints typically involves elliptic differential operators and all of these questions about inverting those operators on the full slice. Do you agree with that, or am I saying something?
I don't think so, but I suspect it's a long discussion we'll have to have at a different point.
Okay, I'll try it here with Ian. Do you agree with the point? I mean, you can see this already in electromagnetism. You have one gauge function. So you don't get to...
I agree with your counting, but I see nothing wrong with using the residual gauge transformations to impose further conditions as long as you have residual gauge transformations.
Well, I'm not criticizing that. I'm saying that the way you presented it, and I perhaps didn't understand because there are details left out, but the way you presented it, you imposed too many gauge conditions. So I didn't quite understand.
He assumed that it obeyed the linearized field equations in a fixed gauge.
Did he solve those equations?
He took the Higuchi solutions for the mode functions, and then he used the residual gauge freedom to try and impose synchronous gauge in the k equals zero coordinate system. So I think that was kosher. I think that's
okay. Well, I have to go through it. But can I ask now a question? How is any of this different for the massless scalar field, which is a simpler system? And do you agree there that what Allen and Fallaci and others showed long ago, that there is no de Sitter invariant state?
Absolutely. It's clear for the massless scalar field.
And how?
The question is whether gravitons are the same physics as the massless scalar or whether they're completely different.
And how are they different? What exactly makes the difference? I have to go through a calculation, or is there, because for a long time we've understood them to be very similar, at least in similar gauges.
So the qualitative difference is clearly that gravitons have a non-trivial gauge invariance, and that they are higher spin. The calculation one must do is to figure out to what extent that affects the answer.
Okay, I agree with that. That's and the final thing I want to do is reaffirm what Richard said at the beginning, that whether or not something is de Sitter invariant, indeed our calculation was de Sitter invariant back in whenever that was, 91 or earlier, it doesn't preclude infrared effects growing as you go outside the horizon. That you agree?
I completely agree.
Okay.
I completely agree. As I say, it would constrain but not prohibit large ions.
Right. Okay. So we'll talk about it here. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Richard.
I
want
to come back to Richard.
Throw me away, please. Thank you, bro. Okay. I wonder if you are aware of a paper that Nick Samus and I published back in 1992 in FIS Letters B. It's probably referenced in the Kleppi paper. It was entitled Mode Analysis and Ward Identities for Perturbative Quantum Gravity and De Sitter.
It doesn't come to mind right. I do not recall the detailed paper right now, so perhaps you wish to remind me.
Okay, so I'll summarize it. What we did was to do that calculation that you're talking about, but just in the k equals zero slicing. So we did the standard analysis that I learned about in Weinberg. I don't know who did it first, where you you impose one gauge condition, use the equations of motion, and then find the residual gauge condition that can make the graviton obey synchronous gauge. And the only difference between what we did and the calculation you're reporting is that we assumed explicitly that the graviton field was not only just a solution of its invariant field equations in the gauge, but also was Fourier transformable. So we assumed that you could write it as a spatial plane wave. It therefore must follow that the term that you're talking about isn't Fourier transformable, cannot be written as a spatial plane wave.
Well, there's a question of whether it's Fourier transformable in a distributional sense or what, but it's certainly not square integral, if that's what you want.
Right. Well, I think our analysis, I think, would give the transformation that would put it in synchronous gauge, if it exists in any sense, in any distributional sense, since we just assumed it had the e to the I k dot x spatial dependence, and if it had that, you can indeed explicitly solve for what the transformation would be as a function of time and k, which would achieve the gauge condition that you want. So what that must mean then is that some of the Higuchi solutions, some of the Higuchi mode functions, have the property that when you write them in open coordinates, in the k equals zero coordinatization, they're not spatially Fourier transformable. And I'd like to suggest a possible resolution that goes then the other way, and that is that perhaps that means, of course, that they're somehow singular at that point, and I suppose we could have guessed that anyway, because that's where infrared problems come from in k equals zero slicing, is from large x. And I'd like to suggest the possibility that then that propagator really isn't a solution of the propagator equation. One thing that could make something infrared converge like a bat out of hell is if you didn't just solve the propagator equation with a plus delta 4 of x minus x prime, but also a minus delta 4 of x minus x prime minus any point. That is, solve for a dipole rather than a monopole source. Then it will, of course, not have infrared problems. It won't, of course, obey the propagator equation as well. And what I'm suspecting is that there's an error very much like the error when you could sort of naively argue that del squared of 1 over r is equal to 0 and miss the delta function contribution because you missed a singularity. And I think you've actually sort of shown that these solutions would have to be singular if you were to transform them into co-moving coordinates, if you were to look at them in their infinite spatial dependence. So that's what I'd like to suggest is going on here.
Well, let me agree that what this shows is that if you take one of these mode functions on global decider, which from the global decider point of view is clearly a good mode function because it's smooth in smooth coordinates. And
except at closed time goes to infinity, right?
How do they behave at infinity, those mode functions?
How do you study perturbations on a space-time? You take an initial data surface somewhere in the middle. You put some smooth
perturbations. Whoa. Somewhere in the middle of what? So I would say that if your result is that we could do that we can't do good physics on the k equals zero slicing, then I would say you should tell the Planck guys and the WMAP guys that they can't measure what they're trying to measure.
That's not what I said. I did not wish to claim that you cannot do good physics in the k equals zero slicing. What I wanted to say is, suppose we decide that we want to work on global de Sitter space, and we want to understand global de Sitter space. Okay? Then I claim that in that context, transverse radius in this AGK equals zero has some singularity. Now, there are lots of physical questions for which you may not want to work on global de Sitter space. For example, as in Steve's question, for many questions you can choose not even the entire k equals zero patch, but just some quotient of it. You can work on an F or W torus. And the physics should not really depend on the torus size. If you play it lasts a long time, and the universe gets very big. Okay. So I think we can do reasonable physics in the k equals zero slicing. But maybe a question about whether you can really address all the questions in global de Sitter using this particular gauge. But all I want to do is to say that what that means is that, well, I think that means that on global de Sitter, there is a de Sitter invariant vacuum state, and that should give us caution in interpreting things like variances that grow with time, because it suggests there is something game-dependent about those masses.
Well, again, I would say that if we ever get into a conflict between whether physics should be done on k equals zero or k equals one, we'll never see de Sitter. I mean, the universe might be locally approaching de Sitter, but it never will have the past light cones, so cosmology has already resolved that one for us.
That's right.
Completely, but I'd like to suggest something even more fundamental, though. I suspect that this propagator that you're talking about on the open coordinate or on the closed coordinate system doesn't really obey the propagator equation, because I think your mode functions become singular at infinite time, which is exactly where the open coordinate system has its infrared problems. And I suggest that what you're getting is the solution to a dipole equation rather than a monopole, which would, of course, be infrared finite, but doesn't obey the propagator equation. It says physically that when you shake your hand here, you have to anti-shake your hand somewhere else.
Okay, I think there's one other comment.
Okay. All I'm asking is a simple question. If we have the mode functions, would you tell us for the k equals plus one slicing, do they diverge as time goes to infinity or not? Just a simple question.
That's a question of which...
If they do, you have problems.
What's true, actually, let's back up a slide or two, and I'll show you one answer to that. Let's stop with the slide where at the bottom it says SI goes like 1 over lambda squared R. Okay? So what's true is that if you compute, say, this particular combination, which is the source function, okay, using those global modes, that yes, that diverges like 1 over lambda squared. Diverges at large time for a generic derivation.
These are the k equals zero.
I'm talking about the k equals plus one. In these k equals zero coordinates. Okay. Now, if instead you express them in terms of the global coordinates, that's the blue line here, the time dependence is a function of the global time, and it turns out that in those coordinates, they decay at large times, exponentially. Okay. So this is a coordinate-dependent question. Because we're talking about tensor modes.
Okay. Can we wrap it up? Is everybody okay with them stopping there?
Okay.